There are many kinds of museums, from the hallowed halls of the Louvre to the humble home of Jesse James, from Tulsa to Tokyo to the Tate Modern. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. What is bad art? Does bad art have a place in the broader art world? What does the word bad even mean in this context? Today we're exploring this and much more with Louise Sacco. 25 years ago, Louise co-founded the Museum of Bad Art, where she still serves as the permanent acting interim executive director. The cheekiness of that title tells us a lot about this unique Massachusetts-based institution, as does the first question on their website FAQ page.
Is this some kind of joke?
Answer: this institution works long and hard at building the finest bad art establishment in the world. We take our mission very seriously. Frankly, we're shocked and indignant at your derisive innuendo. So now you get the gist. We talked with Louise by phone in her office outside Boston. So this is, I believe, your 25th anniversary. You founded the museum in 1993.
That's right.
This fall, you'll be celebrating 25 years. So is it amazing to you that you've been around that long when this was...
We never, never dreamed it would be still going 25 years later. This whole thing started as a one-night event. It was going to be a party. My brother was moving into a new house, so instead of a housewarming, he decided he would call it the opening of the Museum of Bad Art because he had a few pieces of interesting art that friends had given him. And we wrote some descriptions or some interpretations of what we saw in the art and hung them on the walls. And he invited about 50 people to this party, and by midnight there were maybe 200 people in his little tiny suburban house because people were calling their friends saying, you know, you've got to come and see this. And the next morning we decided we had to find a way to keep it going, but even then we never expected it to be running and international and growing in 25 years.
And so you had these people there for this, I guess we'll call that the official museum opening, when you had this party that ended up having 200 guests at it. You know, what was the spirit of the room like? Were they laughing at the art? Were they trying to understand what is this stuff? Because obviously, you know, for lack of a better word, it was curated, I guess, by your brother, or you picked these pieces for that initial...
It was actually curated by Scott Wilson, who was an arts and antiques dealer in Boston, and he had been finding the pieces, and he was a good friend of my brother's. And he'd been giving them to him. And the mood was, wow, look at this. It was just this is great. This is wonderful. And we kept getting that wow. And one of the things that helped us understand was that there's this universal experience. If you're walking past an art gallery with a group of people and someone says, wow, look at that, until you turn around, you don't know if it's going to be really good or really bad. But either way, they wanted to share it with you.
Well, you have this concept of awe and wonder and surprise and wow and all of those things. You're right. It's on the same scale, whether it's something that's atrociously bad or something that is mind-blowingly good. That initial reaction is still a major surprise.
And the need to share.
Yeah, check this out. Because I think one of the things in museums in general, whether it's the Met or the Museum of Bad Art, one of the hardest things is getting people to pause and linger and look at something and actually pay attention. And I'm sure that is not a problem at the Museum of Bad Art because people want to kind of sit and marinate in the wow factor of whether it's bad, you know, or whatever they're trying to deal with. But that first party, you said you guys had a thought of this should be something that could continue. How do you take that to the next step? You know, where does it go from that first party?
Well, it evolved naturally. And the first thing we did is we set up the museum in my brother's basement, and we left it there. And we got some local press attention, and people would call him or call his wife and say, can I come by and see the museum? And so, you know, four or five people a week were coming in to see it.
And like by invitation only, kind of very special.
Yes, exactly. But lots of people were giving him more art. They were finding things in yard sales and flea markets and in their grandmother's attic when they were clearing the house out and things like this. And it got to be too much for that house. I think the tipping point was when a busload of seniors from Rhode Island pulled up on this little suburban street to come and see the museum. And we knew it was time to move on. So we started asking around, and a local movie theater owner said he had some space in his basement. Did we want to use that? And the theater was built in, I think, 1924 and just had lots of history and was fun. And we moved into a movie theater basement. And we are still, we're in a different movie theater now, but still in the basement of a movie theater. And one of the things we decided from the start is that there were five of us involved in the founding team, and nobody wanted to make this a job. We decided from the start that this was going to be a volunteer activity. We were going to keep the museum free, and we've been able to do that. We have no paid staff. Right now there are two of us who are running it and keeping things going with volunteers who help us as needed and wonderful people like a theater owner who gives us space and a moving company that gives us some storage containers and just lots of support like that. We do sell some books and T-shirts and postcards to scrape together enough money to pay for our web hosting and our phone line and, you know, the few expenses we do have.
Early on in those, you know, 25 years ago, obviously there was no web presence at the very beginning. But, it's become, one, mandatory to have a web presence for something like this. But when did you guys start making that transition? Was it something you adopted fairly early on as far as wanting to share some of these works online?
From the very start, we were using the early web. My brother Jerry was a software engineer, and we started using email to keep in touch with the people who were interested and get people together to help out hanging shows and things. So we were on the web in one way from the very start. And one of our earliest efforts was we put together a virtual museum on a CD-ROM when around the same time the Louvre did theirs. And we actually got better reviews. That was, and our virtual museum had something like 38 rooms in it, and lots of people who were discussing the art or the operation of a museum, and it was a lot of fun. From then, it was a natural to start putting things up on a website, and we also have always had an email newsletter. And even today, when that's not such a popular thing, we have about 30,000 people that get our MOBA news, and Facebook, which we've been on, I think, since maybe 2010, we've got 60,000 or so people following us right now. So it's been a great way for us to get attention all over the world. The other thing that's been magic for us is the press. Probably 1996, we learned that there was a Wall Street Journal reporter assigned to Boston. He was new in town, and we figured he probably didn't know anyone yet. So we invited him to an opening of a show, and he came, and he covered us, and we ended up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal.
Wow.
From there, we ended up in publications all over the world, and people would call, a radio station in Brazil, a newspaper in Indonesia, and I would always ask how they'd heard of us, and for about 6 or 8 years, it was always, I clipped it out of the Wall Street Journal.
Can you talk about the value of that? I mean, the getting that, for such a small organization, you don't have funding to do advertisement, you don't have funding to do, some of those traditional outreach things. When you get that free media coverage, that really can make or break you, especially in those early first few years. Do you see that as kind of one of the things that's kept you going this whole time?
Absolutely. And it also has a momentum of its own. The more you're covered, the more other people want to cover you. We've been in probably 20 in-flight magazines. We've been in newspapers, TV, radio, literally all over the world. As a result of all of that, we were invited to do a show in Taiwan a couple of years ago, and we're expecting to do a show in Toronto late in 2018 or early 2019. But all of this is because we got that early push, and beyond that, we don't even do press releases. What we've done is answer the phone since then.
So I wonder, with a project like this, the Museum of Bad Art, I'd like to talk for a second about what that means, because I think people think when you hear something about bad art, it's something you dislike. But when I see what you're doing and I look at the book and I hear the way you talk about it, it's bad, but you guys have a passion for these, and you can truly love something that you know, I guess, from a critical standpoint is not of quality, but from an emotional or even a, you know, unconscious standpoint, you just love it, and something about it says something to you. Can you talk about the relationship you have with this work beyond just the word bad?
Absolutely, and that's really an important thing. Our curator says he wishes we didn't have the word bad in our name, but if we didn't, we wouldn't have got all the attention we did. But what we're saying is that we're celebrating an artist's right to fail. We're saying that even when things go wrong, we can love it, we can share it, we'll find an audience for it. We never say anything negative about the art or the artists that we're involved with because we do love their work. When we talk to young people about art, they sometimes come to Boston to visit our very serious Museum of Fine Arts, and they will come to us first. We try to tell the teachers, come to us before you go there. And what we tell them, and a lot of adults don't get this either, is that there is a continuum, probably, I guess, from universally admired art as fine art, you know, things that as a culture we agree are wonderful, and things that overall most of us agree this is really failed, something's gone wrong here, it's not right. That continuum does not relate well to I like it or I don't like it. They're completely different things. And we're not collecting and caring for and even renovating at times art that we don't like.
Right. You're not making a judgment call on it necessarily in that regard. It's you wouldn't have it in there if it wasn't something that was important to you as an organization, like you were saying with your curatorial point of view. But what about the artist?
I'd like to throw something else in there, too, though. Despite all that, I have no patience with people that want to argue and say there is no such thing as bad art. If we're going to say that there is good art or fine art, that means we are making judgments. And if we're making judgments, then we've got to be able to say that maybe some things are bad.
Well, things can be bad and fascinating. I mean, there's myriad examples in film and music, you know, where people have either overreached or the ambition was there, but the end product didn't match the ambition. And, you know, sometimes messes can be more fascinating than something that's done perfectly. A paint-by-numbers landscape is technically correct, but it's not very interesting.
Right. Well, and that gets to another thing that we've always been insistent on, and that is that the works that we collect need to be art. And to us, that means they need to be sincere and original. So that throws out kitsch, and it throws out paint-by-numbers or velvet paintings. It also throws out somebody who is trying to cynically develop something bad enough to get into our museum.
Right. Irony is not part of the equation here. This is not something where someone says, I'm going to try to make something so horrible I can make it into the Museum of Bad Art.
Exactly. Yeah, we're looking for sincerity. And what happens then is we end up with some of the very same criteria that any museum or many museums have, which is that we're looking for pieces that come from the heart, that are trying to communicate something, that get people talking and thinking and asking questions.
When we think of the art world currently, one thing museums are not traditionally known for is having a sense of humor. But I wonder, what has it been like dealing with peers, if that's the word we want to use, in the museum community? What have you been in a town like Boston that has so many amazing museums? Has this been a welcome addition? Or, you know, have you always been kind of the outside group looking in? How are you treated among the broader museum community?
We are almost universally applauded. I think that most of the people in the world of art understand and see that for one thing, we're never making fun of the art or the artists. If we're making fun of anyone, it's people who talk about and write about art and maybe get a little self-important about it. And we've had maybe one or two situations where there's someone, a traditional art person, who's been very angry with us. And once, tellingly, it was an art professor at a local college, and we had had an exhibit at the college which had him infuriated, and we found out through other people later that the reason he was so furious is he had had an exhibit that had a very low attendance, and we got a great turnout. But I think most people in that world understand that we're supportive of what they do, and we will never walk into some other museum and say, wow, that belongs in the Museum of Bad Art. We're not going to second-guess other museums' curatorial decisions.
Right. When you're dealing with artists specifically, you know, there's stars in the art world, you know, there's the Jackson Pollocks and the Frida Kahlos and all these people. Are there stars in the world of bad art? Is there kind of a Mount Rushmore of bad art?
Not really. We have one artist that we have, I think, half a dozen pieces from. That's very unusual. That's Mari Newman, who's in Minneapolis. And Mari also has work in some more establishment museums. I'm sorry, I don't have her bio in front of me right now, but she's considered an outsider artist. When she has something that didn't work out the way she was hoping, she often offers it to us.
Well, that's a good point. When you have someone like that who's kind of straddling this world of both the kind of traditional museum route and then having pieces there, does this go back to the problem of the word bad a little bit? Meaning, if you tell someone, we love your work and we want to have it in the museum, but the museum is called the Museum of Bad Art, have you ever had any blowback or resistance from artists to say, you know, this is going to make some larger judgment on my work that, you know, could hurt my career or damage my reputation?
Once or twice we've had that happen, but more often the artists are submitting the works themselves. And that took us a while to understand. But what we have got now is that the artist knows that it hasn't worked. And the idea that there may be a place that will appreciate the piece and share it, you know, you've got a lot of very passionate artists have something they're trying to say. They want an audience, and we're going to bring that audience to them. And they also, if they know us at all, know that we're not going to make fun of them, or, you know, that we will truly celebrate the work. And when they submit their work, if we turn them down and say it's not for us, they can tell themselves that I'm not that bad.
I often think about the idea that when you think about the art or the books or the films that we love, I often think there's a dichotomy between what we critically know is quality, but then what we know is our favorite. So, for example, my favorite Bob Dylan album is not the same as the album that I think is his best album. You know, I think there's a difference. One is more personal to me, and it's tied into memories and all these things, but I don't think it's the top, you know, quality output. So I wonder, when you look at these things, do you have something that, you know, is a favorite piece or a few favorite pieces that over the years have stuck with you personally along this journey?
I do, and there's one that is called Sensitive, and it's a small yellow canvas with black lettering saying in heavy black lettering, sensitive, sensitive. And then there's a little cartoon on the bottom, like stick figures of a man offering his heart, and a woman takes it, throws it on the ground, and stomps on it, and he's left crying. And what I love about it is that it just gives you the whole story of this artist at the end of it yelling, sensitive, you want sensitive? I'll show you sensitive. And he makes the most insensitive painting you could imagine. It's wonderful to me that there's a whole drama in this piece.
On your website, you have your collection broken up into categories, and those categories are portraiture, landscape, unseen forces, unlikely landscapes, seascapes, and still lifes, in the nude, which is N-O-O-D, blue people, poor traits, P-O-O-R, traits. Here, the symbols crash. That's here, H-E-R-E. And then recent acquisitions. So obviously, you're having so much fun even in the text of the website. And I love your frequently asked questions. There's so much to, you know, I'm just laughing reading the whole thing. But my favorite certainly is blue people. That's my favorite category.
Well, let me tell you something about that. We are just doing some reworking of our website, and we've decided we need to expand that category. It's going to be called colorful people, because we also have been acquiring some green people and red people and other kinds.
So you're going to diversify the site
exactly.
A little bit. It's not just going to be the domain of blue people anymore. So that's
right.
Good. I wonder, though, I was looking through that, and it started to make me think that there really are, in, you know, I was thinking back to people like Chagall. I'm thinking other artists. You see lots of blue characters in art, and I just wonder, is that something that just happened for that category and all the categories, really, by just seeing an accumulation over time, and you say, hey, we're starting to see some trends afoot here, or how do you go about picking these categories?
Yep. That's exactly it. You've got it, that we've got over 700 pieces. We only have exhibit space for maybe 30 or 40 at a time. So one of the things our curator does a lot is looks at rows of pictures on his computer and you know, looks for things that bring them together and both to pull out shows. We now have a MoBA zoo, too, And we also have, I don't think I heard you say oozing my religion is a category.
Yes, I forgot about oozing my religion. Yeah.
Right, because we were coming up with a lot of religious art. But yeah, it as the art piles up, we start to see these trends, and it just makes it easier for us to think about, too, when we put them in collections.
I've had the opportunity over the years a couple of times to be in the museum with relatives of an artist whose art is on the wall, and that artist has passed away, and maybe it's, you know, grandchildren or a cousin or someone who's getting to see that work in the museum, and you can see them living vicariously and remembering that person. And some of these artists, I would imagine, are people that don't have work up anywhere else. And if someone who is a relative of someone might want to see their work in a quote-unquote museum, this is the place they would go. Have you had any experience with artists who have passed away and had some interaction with some living relatives at some point?
We have. Sandy Winslow, Sanford, I think his name was a local Boston guy, and we had acquired a piece of his from, I think, from a yard sale, and it was a neon-colored face with the word Moore, M-O-R-E, across it. And we had it in a show or something that the picture ended up in the newspaper, and Sandy called us and said, if you like that, you should come to my studio. I've got lots more you'd like. And it turned out he had dozens and dozens of neon-colored faces with words across them, and he loaned them to us, and we did a show called Relentless Creativity, I Just Can't Stop. And 8 or 10 years after that, Sandy died, and his family was checking to make sure we had his piece, that we would still show it, that, you know, it was exactly that. They wanted to make sure that some of his artistic expression lived on that way.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Taste. No, not the sweet, salty, bitter, sour kind of taste, the other kind, the kind most often broken into two camps, good taste and bad taste. Without Taste, museum curators would be lost, selecting works to display by putting names in a hat. That's no way to live. On the other hand, Taste, by its very nature, is in the eye of the beholder. One person's Breaking Bad is another person's Real Housewives of wherever. Perhaps H.L. Mencken said it best.
Nobody ever went broke underestimating the taste of the American public.
To find out where you fall on the taste scale, visit doihavegoodtaste.com for a free 6-hour intensive online evaluation. Some restrictions may apply, void where prohibited by law.
We often talk about what is a museum, and I love the fact that you just decided that you are a museum, because who gets to decide what is a museum and what is not? You could have called yourself a gallery or whatever, but you decided to call yourself a museum. And one thing that's happened is, you know, time, when you factor in time, you've been around long enough, that legitimacy kind of asserts itself over the decades. You know, if maybe it was just a lark at the beginning, but now you've been around for 25 years and it really is an actual thing that has some weight to it. Why did you decide to call it a museum?
No, you've exactly captured it. We did it to give the whole project a legitimacy. And one of the things that would come up often is, at the start, is people saying things like, well, who are you to say what's bad and what's good? And we would confidently say, we are the Museum of Bad Art. Who else knows better? And now we also call ourselves the world's leading authority on bad art. And it hasn't been challenged yet.
Well, I don't think it will be. Thank you so much for taking time to chat with us today. We're excited about seeing what's to come and some of these traveling exhibitions. And maybe someday we'll do a show here in Tulsa from the Museum of Bad Art. That'd be really great.
Would love to do that. It's been a pleasure talking to you,
Jeff.
All right,
thanks. Take care.
Are you so bad? Best thing I ever had.
In 1964, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a decision in a case known as Jacob Ellis versus Ohio. The case was a First Amendment challenge to see if the state of Ohio could ban French director Louis Malle's film, The Lovers. Nino Jacob Ellis was the manager of the Heights Art Theater in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. After screening the film, he was charged and fined $2,500. The conviction was upheld by the Ohio Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court of Ohio. The U.S. Supreme Court reversed the conviction, ruling that the film was not obscene. Four different opinions were issued from the majority, the most famous being that of Justice Potter Stewart. He wrote, "I shall not today attempt to further the kinds of materials I understand to be embraced within that shorthand description, hardcore pornography, and perhaps I could never succeed in intelligibly doing so, but I know it when I see it, and the motion picture involved in this case is not that." That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.
Let's go!